delightful to be here in Eau Claire, a beautiful, beautiful part of the state. And we, the first hour of our program today, have a political science professor with us who is chair, actually, of the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Jeffrey Peterson is with us. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and also American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. His research focuses on election and political behavior, causes of voter roll-off, American Indian voting, late-night talk show politics, and committees in the Senate. We have a lot to talk about. It's been a while since we have had a chance to look at gun issues and to respond to the vote in the Senate on gun legislation. We will discuss that. We'll look at the status of enemy combatants. And are people worried that there are terrorism cells throughout the United States? How is government responding to that? The sequester is starting to kick in, and there are delays at airports now all over the country. We will talk about that, and we'll look at a number of other issues as well. We have a phone number from Madison because we're in Eau Claire, so we're using the Madison phone number today, and that number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 for your response on any of the aforementioned topics or whatever you would like to talk about. Professor Jeffrey Peterson, thank you very much for joining us in the studios in Eau Claire.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I've been thinking a lot. I take these issues, and we all do, so much to heart. The horrific events that took place in Boston last week, Newtown not that long ago as well, and we have the president coming for these national grieving events that are taking place. It almost appears to me as though that's what this country is doing now. We know how to grieve. We've had events that we shouldn't have to respond to, but government doesn't seem to be able to do much of anything. Am I way off base with that analysis?
Well, the problem is that when you have a society that is both, that puts an enormous emphasis on freedom and an enormous amount of, you know, allowing people to behave in ways that other societies might restrict, it opens the door for, obviously, behavior that many of us would consider unacceptable, right? And when taken to an extreme, that behavior can result in things like Newtown, things like Boston. And, you know, government's not in a position to figure out how to help us grieve, unfortunately. I mean, we can have vigils, we can have, you know, President Obama say things, but it's not the kind of thing that government's good at. And when government tries, I think as a general rule, it fails. Or it appears artificial. And that then leads to, you know, people think, oh, well, this is all about politics. It's not about the process. It's not about really, you know, I mean, Bill Clinton was good at it. Bill Clinton knew how to connect with voters and connect with citizens. And I think that he was able to, you know, I think of the Oklahoma City bombing and his, right, his connection to voters and to the citizens of Oklahoma was really powerful. But I think most politicians now are so afraid to say the wrong thing and so afraid to appear to be taking political advantage of something that they're then unwilling to make that connection and actually go through a genuine process to some degree.
But the other thing that's happening is you have these events and you have government unable to respond to a desire to do something about guns in this country. So instead, you have a vote on the part of the American public that is very much at odds at what the Senate does. You have what happened in Boston, people saying that this guy should be an enemy combatant or he shouldn't be an enemy combatant. So we're having these partisan debates over these national tragedies, and nothing seems to get done.
Well, I think you've got two issues. First of all, as much as we would like to think the government's job is to respond to popular opinion, at certain points, and I'm not saying these are those, but at certain points, you don't want government to respond to popular opinion. In the 1950s, if we'd gone with popular opinion, we'd have rounded up every union leader, every person who was even remotely connected to the Communist Party and put them all in jail. Right. So that there are times when the public gets inflamed on an issue in the short term that maybe it doesn't work in the best interests of, for example, the Bill of Rights. Now, I'm not saying that these are those situations, but there are times when politicians have to act in the interests of the nation rather than in the interests of public opinion. Now, and I think that's the argument that most of these politicians would make. I mean, if you talk to the senators who voted, for example, against the background check bill, they would argue that what they were doing was looking out for the interests of the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment, and
yes.
that any one incident is not as important as the broader principles underlying that. That said, at a certain point, of course, they can be held. I mean, they may be held responsible for the vote when the elections come up. I mean, obviously, the ultimate poll, if you will, is an election.
Mm-hmm.
And if the citizenry decides they want background checks and they want stricter gun control in large enough numbers, some of these senators will lose their seats. And some of the House members who would have voted against it, had it ever gone there, will also lose their seats.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always that balancing act between what does the public want versus sort of these bigger questions. But it does often make the government appear like it's not responding. I think you're absolutely right. But that's because in many ways the government's not really supposed to.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not designed for immediate responses to crisis. I mean, it's part of the reason that the bailout was such a disaster is because they weren't prepared for, nor are they really equipped for, that sort of immediate large action. Essentially our government's designed to work in very slow, incremental ways. And so big change is hard for them to handle.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Marathon bombings for just a moment. Are you worried, and I'm wondering what you think is the process that's underway right now to discover if there are a substantial number or even a few can create great deal of havoc of homegrown terrorism cells in this country?
Well, that goes back to the problem of having a lot of freedom is that then it becomes much harder to keep an eye on people like that. I mean, if we were the old Soviet Union, we would know exactly who was doing what every day and what they were buying, and we would know if they were building bombs. Unfortunately, we place a much greater value on, our individual freedoms, and so that opens the door for this sort of behavior, absolutely. Are there other cells like this? I think it's entirely possible. I mean, I don't think we can rule that out. White supremacist groups have acted out. I mean, Timothy McVeigh and a variety of other organizations like that on multiple occasions. So I think you have homegrown, whether you want to call them terrorists or whatever you want to call them. I'm sure they see themselves as freedom fighters, right? That's all part and parcel, I think, of having that much freedom is that things like this are going to happen on occasion. Obviously, we want government to do as much as possible to contain it. But I think it's unavoidable to some degree that as long as we allow people to behave, to allow people an enormous amount of freedom, occasionally some people will take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this debate over Dzhokhar Tsarnaev's being tried in civil court or being labeled an enemy combatant and going through military court is a valuable discussion to have? And does it have something to do with our democratic process?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's very valuable. I mean, up until 9/11, the definition of enemy combatant had been pretty clear. You pretty much had to be in a uniform. You had to be, part of an armed force, the armed forces of another nation. So this idea that essentially anyone could be defined as an enemy combatant and thus tried in a military court is really the U.S. redefining that post 9/11. And in some ways that redefinition made sense. I mean, you couldn't really define al-Qaeda as they're not a state. They weren't, there's a lot of things they weren't. But at the same time, it's not a definition we want to use loosely. If for no other reason, then we don't want other nations using it in the same way against our civilians. And so, you need to be careful how you define it because and frankly, as far as I can tell, and I'm not an expert on military justice, but my sense is that the military doesn't particularly want to deal with this either. I mean, that they see that as being pretty far outside of the bounds of what they're used to doing. And I don't think that they want to have to deal suddenly with, dozens or hundreds of, what are really would have normally been civilian trials going through military courts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is an important discussion to have, though, because we haven't clearly drawn a line yet. The Bush administration expanded the definition but never really decided where it stopped. And al-Qaeda was easy. right? I mean, that's an easy one to pick as an enemy combatant. Now we get into that phase of, okay, but who isn't? And so I think this discussion is very valuable. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I know your area isn't all the international relations, although you'll probably have a comment on this. I'm wondering, considering the fact that the relationship between Russia and the United States is not really top-notch right now, but the Russians have it in their interest to let us know how bad things are in Chechnya.
Right.
How much cooperation can there be, will there be, needs there to be between the United States and Russia in finding out about the Russian trip of the older brother and dealing with all the political issues that arise from Chechnya?
Well, you know, as a practical matter, as a legal matter, that's probably sort of a sideshow. I mean, the truth is there's plenty of evidence in terms of a basic civil court criminal proceeding to address, I mean, to deal with this, unless the defense tries to bring up some sort of an argument that that the Russians were behind there, the Chechens were behind this. And then, of course, things get a lot messier. And obviously the Chechen-Russian thing is one of the uglier, unpublicized wars that's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah.
And the level of violence and brutality on both sides is really quite remarkable. I'm sure the Russians would just as soon we not talk about that. I mean, they don't need that. They don't want that publicized, I don't think. So I suspect it's not going to be a big deal, but I'm not a Chechen expert, so I'll defer to my colleagues who are on that one.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other question before we go to phone calls is, maybe I just take things in pretty deeply when it comes to all of this and spend too much time watching the news and becoming totally absorbed. But there is something unnerving about all of this. There's something unnerving about having this happen on the heels of Newtown, which was a horrendous experience in America. I think people feel a little frazzled. They feel they don't exactly know what's going on. What can government do, if anything, to allay those kinds of very real and deep fears?
You know, honestly, I'm not convinced that government can do a whole lot, because I think back to 9/11, and what's the single biggest thing that the federal government did to reassure our fears after 9/11? Well, they started telling us we couldn't carry more than 3 ounces worth of liquid on a plane, and they came up with that ridiculous color-coding terrorism scheme that was just silly. I'll never forget, every time I drove into the Minneapolis airport, the terror color was always the same. It never changed, ever. It was always orange. And so, you know, as much as I think we would like government to deal with this, you know, I don't think there's much they can. They can do some sort of symbolic actions. But in the big scheme of things, this is something that we as a society have to figure out how to address. And we have to decide, you know, how far do we want freedoms to extend, and where are we willing to draw lines? I mean, I think of the Brits, for example. They have, you know, closed circuit cameras everywhere. They're one of the most highly videoed societies in the world, and it makes it a lot easier for them to catch terrorists and catch criminals. But are we willing to give up that freedom? You know, because there is. I mean, it means that everything you do anywhere in public is caught on video somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Are you willing to give up the freedom to, you know, spit on the sidewalk in order to catch a terrorist? Well, I mean, you know, that those are the kind of decisions that we haven't wrangled with, really, as a country, very well. And it's not the sort of national debate that we've really had up to this point.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. We have a lot to talk about this hour, so join in any of what we've already discussed or bring us in new directions. Our guest this hour, and we're broadcasting live. I haven't done this in a long time. We're in Eau Claire. It's fun to get out on the road, although it wasn't fun last night to be
out on the road.
Oh, my goodness. If you're going to be in good hands, Dean Kallenbach is your guy. He's the guy to drive you through a blizzard in Wisconsin, which we encountered. He's a good driver. And he's guiding our board here today, too. Jeffrey Peterson is our guest here in Eau Claire. We're broadcasting live from our Eau Claire studios. He's a professor and department chair in the Department of Political Science. We're concentrating on the Senate vote on guns. We, of course, are paying attention to what happened in Boston, and we're talking about partisanship and how we get things accomplished in a number of issues. Here's our number. It's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. One line is open for you. You can also send a message in case you can't get through on the phone, and that's talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, broadcasting live from our studios in lovely Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we thought it would be worth our while to listen to people who have been victims of gun violence, and it should be a very powerful show. One of the young men I know, Amardeep Kalika, he is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, but he is a member of the Sikh community, and you'll recall that about a year ago, there was a horrible massacre in Oak Creek. His father, who was the president of the Sikh temple, was killed. And Amardeep has gone on to work with other people who are victims of gun violence all over the country and really all over the world. And we're going to be talking to him and also with Colin Goddard, who's Assistant Director of Victims and Youth Advocacy in federal legislation for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He was shot four times at the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007. So if we're going to listen to people respond to gun violence, I think their voices need to be heard. They're important voices. All right, let's hop to some phone calls. And let's go to Dave in Menominee first. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to talk about the enemy combatant issue here. Yesterday, Congressman Peter King was on Chuck Todd's show, and I was just shocked at some of the things he was saying. They wanted to take this guy, label him an enemy combatant, because they'd be able to get 30 days with this guy to extract information, to torture this kid, to deprive him of sleep and do all the wonderful things. And he said, so he doesn't have the ability to remain silent. And he acknowledged that he wanted to extract this information from this kid, knowing that he wouldn't be able to use it in court. Any of the information would never be used against this guy, just to extract information. He's an American citizen. You know, I know the story behind him. It's on American soil, and this is like the 24 mentality. Remember that show 24?
No, I don't. But Dave, how do you think he should be tried?
I think he should be tried as a criminal in our courts, and be proud that our court system can handle a situation like this. We have plenty of terrorists in maximum security prisons here, and this is about fear. Let's not be afraid to say.
Okay, Jeffrey Peterson.
Well, I mean, I think he raises a legitimate question, and certainly in the case of Peter King, Representative King from New York, he's pretty widely known because of 9/11 and because of a variety of other things for his pretty outspoken positions on this issue. So it doesn't shock me at all that he would say that he would want to find a way to, let's be honest, to torture this kid for information. I also think that first of all, that's not a decision that Peter King gets to make. Obviously, that's a decision that the president will make through the Department of Justice. I also think that it does reflect, though, that fear, that question of, well, okay, they say it was just the two. I mean, or the one who's still alive says it was just the two of them. Do we know that's true? You know, the Boston police, and it's funny, I have a former student who's was in part of the area that was locked down, actually, in Boston.
Oh, really?
And he was saying, how do we know there aren't a dozen other piles of bombs sitting around, and so there is that fear, that mm-hmm. fear that, you know, what if there are 40 others, and we don't know about it, and that's the sort of fear that brings out this sort of this right. this desire, and it's a natural fear because, I mean, let's be honest, there are very few things more frightening in politics, period, than unprovoked, unannounced attacks on civilian targets. Mm-hmm. I mean, yesterday, you know, we get the Boston massacre yesterday. What if next it's the Mall of America? or a high school commencement ceremony, or right? I mean, you know, those are the sort of things. Yeah, those are the sort of possibilities that really do terrify people, and legitimately so. And so I don't think it comes as a surprise that some people would react in the sense of, well, we have to make sure that there isn't anybody else. Now, I disagree with Representative King. I think that there's not a lot of evidence to support that here. But the reaction does make a sort of, you know, an intuitive sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it has a real raw emotional appeal to it that doesn't really surprise me. So,
well, there's also a whole lot to be said because so much of the world lives in completely different systems of government than we do, repressive regimes. Mm-hmm. There is a great deal to be said for transparency in America and for putting this person on trial so we can all hear the testimony. As much as I'm glad that they got Osama bin Laden, I have often thought, wouldn't it have been remarkable to put him on trial in the United States to show the rest of the world what our system of justice is, to make sure that it's an open and clear transparent process, which really should be a part of our democracy.
And I would agree. I mean, I think part of what makes a democracy work is that everyone is subject to the same civil code, right? I mean, that's, you know, that goes all the way back to Magna Carta, you know, this idea that, you know, no one is above the law and the law is applied equally to all, no matter how heinous the crime. And that's the problem, that is the issue with this enemy combatant question, is that it essentially says there are certain people who are now going to be treated differently. And in the past, that had only been in case of war, and war has always been assumed to be a different set of circumstances. But when you start expanding the definition, then you do essentially create two classes, if you will, of justice. And that gets into some very mushy territory very quickly.
Yeah. We're broadcasting live from Eau Claire, Wisconsin this morning, and our phone number will be the Madison number that you hear frequently. It's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. John in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hello, John. Hello, John. Yeah, John. Well, John doesn't seem to be there, so let's try another line here. Dwayne in Hayward. Are you there, Dwayne? Dwayne in Hayward. I don't know if we're missing our phone calls or not. Well, we'll figure out what the problem is and move on. Let me give you the phone number. Well, no, let me give you the email address because they can get through on that probably. talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And our phone number, I can see the lines are all filled, so we're just having a problem pressing buttons. Let's try one more here. And it's Greg in Lombard, Illinois. Greg, hello.
Good morning, Kathy.
All right, Greg. Hey.
I have lots to say, but I'll cut it back because I'm not the guest. So,
all right.
I'm a 22-year Air Force pilot, retired. I was trained in special operations. One of the things I learned, and you've heard it on the news, terrorists win if they change your way of life. And you know what? We've let them do that. Let's look. 9/11. We have a Patriot Act. We have people checking my email. We have people checking my library records. I spent 22 years in uniform to defend the Constitution. I just don't understand where this country gets off with an incident happens. I'm not – Boston was terrible. But let me give you two statistics. In 30 years, going back 30 years, according to MSNBC, you know, you could say that's biased – 900,000 people were killed by guns in this country. 3,500 people were killed by terrorism. Okay? And then we have the gun vote. In the same time, over a million people were killed in car accidents. Now, we don't... I'm sorry. I'm just frustrated. I hate Boston happening, but I don't want Boston to change the way we live. Mm-hmm. We are a free country, and we...
Greg, what are you worried about? What do you think is going to change that would bother you?
Well, look what happened to 9/11. I don't want to sound like I'm a wacko, but...
You don't at all.
We're hearing about the we're talking about Chechens.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pronounce it right, but You know, I was in Oklahoma when Timothy McVeigh and his partner blew up the Murrah building.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't hear a great outcry because, and I, again, I'm not trying to be racist, it was a white man that did this. All of a sudden, we throw in this foreign potential,
yeah,
and oh my God.
All right, great. Thanks very much, Greg, for your call. I don't mean to cut you short, but we have a ton of phone calls coming through. Do you think that there will be change? I don't know what more we can do. We take our shoes off. We do all of these things. I don't know how much more we respond to this. Do you think that we will?
No, I don't see a significant response to this on the part of government as a practical matter because, I mean, you can't. This is exactly the sort of behavior that you really can't regulate without a massive increase in government control on behavior, and I don't see that happening. I mean, you would have to implement an enormous number of new, you know, restrictions on what people can buy and where they can go, or instituting lots of random checks in public places, and I don't see that as happening. And now, you know, if we have a dozen more of these bombings in the next month, you know, then we end up looking more like Israel. You know, I mean, if you, I don't know if you've ever been to Israel, but you know, Israeli security is crazy because people blow up buses all the time.
Right.
And so, you know, it takes you an extra hour to get on an airplane and a variety of other things. But that's because that has been their response over time to these sort of events. I think the events are still rare enough here in the United States that we've not seen that sort of reaction. I mean, yes, obviously we had the Patriot Act after 9/11, but In the big scheme of how national security could be implemented on a sort of individual behavioral level, and is Patriot Act is, you know, one step out of maybe 100.
Yeah.
So,
do you have any idea? I was thinking about this because I'm sure, both for political reasons and for legitimate reasons, there are questions about how Tamerlan got through the FBI watch list, that there wasn't more careful scrutiny of him. And it got me thinking, are there a lot of people on the terrorist watch list? Would it be unusual for somebody like him to slip through without being watched more?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Of course, the watch list is a very closely guarded secret, and so no one really knows exactly how many people are on it. I've heard numbers quoted in the thousands, but I don't know if that's correct or not. And, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, my suspicion is, and again, this is a guess based on what little I know, is that there's probably different levels. You know, some people are more highly watched than others and you know, more likely to get flagged. And it sounds like there wasn't, frankly, a whole lot in his background that would put him really high up on the people we need to be watching on a, you know, daily basis sort of list. So, no, I'm not particularly surprised by that. No.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're going to go to Duane. Hello, Duane in Hayward.
Yes, I hope you can hear me this time.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, everybody. What I want to talk about is gun rights. The Second Amendment is just as strong as the First Amendment. And if we enforce that as we did the First Amendment, everybody would be able to walk, have a gun and walk with it any place they wanted. It's really become, how can I say this, issue of the left here to try to destroy the Second Amendment. And why, Kathleen, why aren't you having people who've defended themselves on with guns instead of gun violence victims all the time? There are tens of thousands of people who defend themselves every year at firearms, and I never hear that side from you, Kathleen. You're always having people who are victims of gun violence instead of people who have defended themselves with guns.
Well, we are happy to do a show with people who have defended themselves. I in no way, I underline, will I apologize for having our guests who will be with us the second hour of the program. They have taken the most significant loss that anybody can take. One almost lost his life because of a mass killing at Virginia Tech. The other lost his father in a horrible massacre at the Sikh temple in Milwaukee. And I think that their voices need to be heard, and what they have to say about how to make this a more peaceful country is something that needs to be heard, and I will not apologize for that. And we'll do the other thing that you want down the road sometime.
Well, I just want to jump in and say one thing, and that is, you know, I hear this argument about the equivalency of the First and the Second Amendment. And actually, I think that's absolutely true. But it's also true that we put an enormous number of restrictions on the First Amendment. I can't sell child pornography. I can't gather people, right? You know, we have the right for public assembly, but I can't assemble them all in the middle of I-94 to hold a protest without getting myself arrested. You know, they say freedom of religion, absolutely, but I'm not allowed to do human sacrifice as part of that. So the reality is that the government has always put restrictions on the First Amendment. There are actually more restrictions on the First Amendment than there are on the Second. And the notion that the First Amendment is somehow this completely unrestricted—I mean, I can't, you know, if I were to drop the F-bomb right here on the radio, someone would be getting a call from the FCC within about 15 minutes, and then I'd have to write a check to WPR. And so— All right. So the idea that there are no restrictions on the First Amendment is just is an artifice. It's simply not true. And so if we can put restrictions on the First Amendment, then it would seem logical we could also put restrictions on the Second.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a change in the influence of people who are concerned about guns in this country as a result of what the country has gone through? Do you see a lobby that is growing that may be as powerful, I don't know, as heavily financed as the NRA, but do you see that happening?
Well, I think there is an interesting change happening. And as someone who has paid a lot of attention to gun law and gun politics for about 20 years now, you know, I think about post-Columbine and, you know, points like that in which really debates about gun control appeared and disappeared very, very quickly. And, you know, you never want to give too much credit or too much blame to any one individual. But I've got to say that I think the involvement of Mayor Michael Bloomberg and all of this, because of the incredibly deep pockets that he has, the money
yes.
that he has to spend, I think makes a difference. Because obviously, you know, you look at any survey over the last 30 years, and there is a significant majority of Americans who favor at least some forms of gun control. I mean, whether it be restrictions on assault weapons or background checks or whatever. I mean, the numbers are actually pretty consistent over mm-hmm. time. The difference is now, I think, that the gun control lobby now has more money behind it than it ever has. And I think it has a few key players like Gabby Giffords who get the sort of national attention. You know, I think about, the Brady Bill, right? Where did the Brady Bill? Okay, well, it was from press secretary, Ronald Reagan's press secretary, and shot in the head,
right.
You know, during the assassination attempt. It takes people like that. The problem that the gun control lobby has and always has had is that for people who are Second Amendment advocates, that is a single issue vote for them. They will decide on mm-hmm. who to vote for based only on that position in many cases, and everything else is sort of irrelevant. That's not true for most of the people who are in favor of gun control. There are a lot of other issues that matter to them, whether it be abortion or prayer in schools or education funding or whatever. And so they don't make that, you know, for example, you know, will senators be punished for this vote on background checks? I don't know, because even the ones who are potentially vulnerable to it in you know, Democrats in districts that are they could lose, or Republicans in swing states, there are going to be a lot of people who won't make that their deciding vote. And therefore, they can survive politically because they don't have to face the sort of direct reaction that a Second Amendment lobby can bring.
Mm-hmm. So. And one final question for me on this before we go back to phone calls. Was it a failure of presidential leadership on this issue that kept that Senate vote from going the other way? Was he not very effective?
Oh, no, absolutely. Actually, the truth is, my read on this is that the more involved Obama came, the harder it was going to be for Republicans to switch over and vote for it, because especially among the base of the party, cooperation with the administration is seen as such a heresy. I think that he did exactly the right thing by not getting involved. I think he would have made it more difficult to pass had he been involved.
Really?
Absolutely. If there's any place he could have had leverage, it could have been with the Democrats who didn't vote for it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there were four of those. But especially among Republicans, I think the sense that the greater the level of presidential involvement, the harder it was going to be for them to cross over. I think it's far more if you want to lay the blame at anyone's feet, I think the blame has to go at the feet of Harry Reid. I think that he failed to keep his party members in line, and that's you know, that's a big part of the majority leader's job is to do that. So
let's go to Fred next in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. I was wondering if the mainstream press, the television networks, were just cowered into what they said about the bombing. I found out a lot more information on the Drudge Report or the Huffington Post as to what was going on rather than television. And a case in point, I doubt if most people know, but the bombing suspect number one who died, his best friend was killed along with two of his roommates. They had their throats slit. And the bombing suspect number one didn't even attend his funeral, and I've never read that in the...
Yeah, I read that this morning on Huffington Post. Where do you think there is stuff? And I've read Drudge Report on this too. Who's got other cells all over the country? Where do you go? Where did you go, and where do you go now to get the best information on all of this, most complete?
Well, you know, a couple of things. I'll say this. You know, Huffington Post, Drudge Report, a lot of these sites, they can get away, frankly, with publishing stuff that is, shall we say, less factually clear than a mainstream news outlet can. I mean, if CBS were to go on the air and say some of that stuff, they could, and it turns out to not be true, they could, you know, they've discredited themselves in front of 100, you know, million viewers. So I think that it's not surprising that you see online news in particular providing more of this sort of sketchy. I mean, because I don't know how much of it's true, and that's a big part of the problem with, I mean, the internet. You know, wasn't it who was it that just had Dick Cheney dead last week for about a week for about an hour online?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you know, as far as where I go for news, I'm a huge, obviously, consumer of news. It's a big part of my job,
mm-hmm.
And so the source that I actually rely on the most, outside of course, National Public Radio.
Of course,
gotta
it's
get
number
that
one.
Right, right.
We knew that.
I actually like reading. I find reading foreign press to be very helpful because
mm-hmm.
I think it takes out a lot of the political nature of the U.S. and pulls it away. So I'm a big fan of The Economist. I read, you know, a couple different newspapers out of London on a regular basis. And then I try and stay in touch with sort of the major news outlets as much
right.
as I can. You know, some are more useful than others.
Yeah. And if you're going to read what's going on in Boston, read The Globe. They were last week.
Boston Globe. Boston Globe is wonderful.
Let's pause for a moment. We'll return and take more phone calls. We're broadcasting live today from studios in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, as I was a speaker last night at the Northwest Listeners Dinner, which took place in Hudson. Beautiful town. Beautiful town. Beautiful part of the state. Except that there shouldn't be any snow. I'm sorry. I shouldn't go on about it because other people have got 60 degrees, but you wouldn't believe it. You just wouldn't believe it. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about really kind of an all things political show. The first hour of our program, Jeffrey Peterson is our guest, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Please join us for the second hour of the program. We will hear from victims of gun violence concerning their thoughts about the Senate vote last week. Amardeep Kalika, who is an Emmy Award winning filmmaker, and his father, president of the Sikh Temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, was killed about a year ago. He's now working with people from different belief systems all over the world to build a more peaceful world. Colin Goddard will also join us. And Colin was shot four times at Virginia Tech in 2007. He's now working with the Brady Campaign to prevent gun violence. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Use our Madison call-in number today because we're in Eau Claire, if that makes any sense. It's 800-642-1234. Tomorrow I'll return to Milwaukee and our number will go back. 800-642-1234. You can send a message. We haven't had any messages, and that would be nice. That's talk@WPR.org. Larry in Green Bay, our next caller. Hello, Larry.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to see a couple points here. In the last few days, there was a story on the news that said 60% of all gun deaths in this country are suicides. And those people are bent on suicide. They're going to do it, gun or no gun. And the second point is that, oh, sometime in the last 3-4 months, the Green Bay police were on the news, and it was just a flash on the 6 o'clock news. It said 83% of all guns seized in Green Bay were related to marijuana. So, you know, these things cover the broad spectrum of gun crimes or gun deaths, and if you take that stuff out of there, there's not nearly as much to deal with as you would think.
There's a lot to deal with, Larry. Larry, what are your thoughts on a universal background check? Are you in favor or opposed?
I'm opposed. It just is too intrusive, and it's not necessary. I mean, if you take the mental health patients out of it, and what we have to realize is this is 300 million people plus in this country, and there are a lot of crazy people, and there's going to be, you know, the number of actual guns used in crimes is very statistically small per capita of person. So I don't see, you know, that we can really deal with that.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, and we have one line open right now if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about what happened in Boston. We're talking about the Senate vote on guns. We're talking about what happens now in terms of fighting terrorism that's essentially homegrown, and a number of issues. Let's go to Karen in Colfax next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm calling because I think it's time for us to begin discussing a repeal of the Second Amendment. That's a fringe position now, but if you think of all of the major changes in our society that have taken place, even in the last generation, it would have been crazy when I was in high school or college to think about gay marriage being a, you know, mainstream issue, and now it's a mainstream issue. We have taken cigarettes out of our culture, totally. When I was in high school, there were smoking lounges for the kids, and they're gone. Cigarettes are completely stigmatized. I think we need to stop. We need to push this conversation much further, and it's time for a major change in our society. My rights as a person who does not wish to be surrounded by guns everywhere I go, who does not wish to have children, who are afraid to go to school, which is what I have now, are being infringed upon by the gun lobby. And
all right,
I think
thank
it's
you,
time
Karen.
To really start pushing it.
Thank you, Karen. It doesn't seem to me as though that's very likely to happen. You can't even get a universal background check passed. You're going to get an examination of the Second Amendment?
Well, I think there's two things to think about here. The first question is, are we at a point now where we will start to see greater involvement of the government by the government in, you know, firearms? And I think the answer is not yet, but I suspect that if you look at the polling data, the people who are most likely to support you know, be NRA members, be hardcore advocates for gun rights, are over 60 and they're white, which makes them two populations. I mean, both of those characteristics are populations that are on the decline. So in the long run, I think the demographics of American society, you know, as generational replacement comes in, will make it more likely that we will start to see at least some success. You know, will we repeal the Second Amendment? You know, that strikes me as a long shot. You know, it takes a lot of votes to pull that off. But will we start to see gun control groups have greater levels of success over, say, the next 20 years? I think that's entirely possible.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Let's go to more phone calls. 800-642-1234 is our number. And just a reminder that we're broadcasting live from Eau Claire, Wisconsin today. We go to Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. Good morning. It seems like a lot of the conversation about this gun control is there are people who are saying that acting like the Second Amendment was to enable the people to be armed against their government. Let me read the Second Amendment's 18 words. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. That's what it says, a well-regulated militia. That's not what we're talking about here. And all the people with their hair on fire about protecting ourselves against the government, where was the outrage when the Fourth Amendment, which is much more important to a democratic society, was basically eliminated by the Patriot Act, and everyone voted for it except for Russ Feingold? Not a peep from the NRA or any of these people who are hair on fire about their freedoms. You know, it's like incomprehensible. I wish some sort of rational, reasonable thought would be applied to this problem. And we register our cars. We register to get married. What is the big deal?
All right. Thank you, Willem and Jeffrey.
Well, I'll say this. One of the things that I think creates the biggest problem with the Second Amendment is that it is without question the most grammatically poorly constructed part of the Constitution. It really is. I mean, there's just – I don't care if you're in favor of the Second Amendment or not. The sentence is about the most and having Willem read it proves it. It's just the most awkwardly written with that huge phrase, prepositional phrase in front of it. And so it's not quite clear what the modifier actually is. And that's what creates the problem. You know,
right.
I don't know that I'm in favor of repealing the Second Amendment, but how about editing for clarity? Should that be allowed at some point? Can we just, rewrite it into one sentence that actually everyone agrees means something, whatever that meaning might be? I mean, I think and that has always been, the fundamental problem here is that the horrible grammar here creates an enormous problem. So
we'll have to do that sometime, just have people rewrite it for us and call in what they have to say. That might be kind of interesting, huh? Do we have time for another phone call? Let's go to Marcus in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Earlier you were talking about news sources, and I'm awake at night and I listen to the BBC, and that's where I first learned about the bombing. Mm. Then I turned the TV on and I was watching, flipping back and forth to two networks that were covering it. And all of a sudden, during this point, they kept showing the older brother, I believe, and he was lying in the street, and he had been, fatally wounded. And all of a sudden, they're showing him, and they're saying that there's another guy, the second guy on the loose. And then all of a sudden, they came in with a CNN deal where they showed a young man. He was stripped down, and he was being escorted into a police car. And they're saying that they got the second guy, and now they're saying, but still, there's another guy on the loose. And so, but for 2 hours, and they only showed that once. But so I was very confused, and I just wonder if you might have seen that or what that meant. Real unusual that CNN popped in all of a sudden. And
CNN was really off the mark on their coverage last week. It was really off the mark. Trying to be first. Let's get it out there. Let's get it out there.
Although my favorite one is there was a local station out of, I think it was California somewhere, that briefly listed the second suspect as being Zoe Deschanel. That's the name they put underneath the picture. I was like, wait a minute, really? Yeah, because she actually tweeted about it saying, no, seriously, I'm not a suspect, honestly.
Oh, my.
Well, that's what happens when everyone tries to get the story out first, right? Is occasionally we get it wrong.
Yeah. I found myself going to, I don't know how to send tweets, if that's correct, but I was going to Twitter to get my information that night because it was on the scene information.
Yep.
Which was good. Well, we're almost out of time.
Goodness, how'd that happen?
Well, it just, there was so much to talk about, and it was interesting. Thank you so much,
absolutely,
Jeffrey, for being
absolutely
with us. Thank you. Jeffrey Pearson, our guest this hour, as we broadcast live from our studios in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Lovely place to be. We were here for the Northwest Wisconsin Listener Dinner, which took place in Hudson. Last night, Jeffrey is a professor and department chair, Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. And we thank him for covering so many different issues that we covered during the course of this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. And thanks to Dean Kallenbach for doing on-air running the board here in Eau Claire. And thanks to We're a real statewide effort today. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who's in Madison, answering phone calls for us. And thanks to Michelle Good for being of help with us today, too.